This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and I guess I should break it to you right now. There are just so many incredible elements to Augie Palacios' World War II story that I think, in fairness, we're going to have to continue this conversation with him next week. It's hard to believe he's 93 years old, and I'm glad we finally have him here on Hometown Heroes. Tell you a little of the background. One of my favorite places in Fresno is the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. And in the foyer there, you'll find giant replicas of prestigious medals with engraved lists of names underneath them representing local servicemen and women who've received those medals. In fact, you'll find my grandfather's name on the Silver Star and the Bronze Star. But on the Distinguished Flying Cross list, you'll find our guest today. And one of the docents at the museum, Les Traeger, has long been telling me how remarkable Augie's story was, from enlisted man fighting on Guadalcanal with the Marines to aerial gunner to fighter pilot. Not too many made that journey. I'm glad we finally have Augie on the program. And not too many of us would know what it feels like to be diving on a Japanese bomber firing a steady stream of lead from all six 50 caliber machine guns on an F4U-4B Corsair. That's where we left Augie before the break, and you said you shot that bomber like you were shooting a dove, but then what?
So I went to pull out, and my Corsair didn't want to come out of it. In those days, we didn't know it. When you come close to the sound barrier, you don't have much control of that Corsair because all it wanted to do was porpoise on its own. And you tried to catch it as it was porpoising up. You pull back for all your worth on the stick to get keep the nose up there. I thought I was a goner again, but pretty soon it started to come out. And one of the things you always have to do, much as you don't want to, you pull the throttle off so you can slow down. It responded, so by the time I got back into flying conditions again, Teague had already got two of his planes gone. And the restroom had all tore off. We were both out of fuel, so we head back to the carrier. And poor old Teague, he read the riot act to me, "You stupid knucklehead." I'll never forget. Two of us against eight airplanes. Whether there was eight or seven, I'm not sure. He said there was eight. Boy, we scattered those Japs all over the sky. I'm still surprised that the CO didn't call me on the carpet, but he was glad to see the report when we finally wrote it up. I'm sure he was. But he must have thought the same thing. Two knuckleheads.
And did you guys take out all eight Japanese planes?
Well, we couldn't have gotten all of them because some of them got away.
Yeah.
Like when I was chasing that bomber, they must have had 10 or 20 machine guns on there, and he was blowing fire all from all parts. Usually when you're going in on an airplane, you always try to get underneath the tail assembly because he can shoot either way, back, left, right, but not dead center because his tail's in the way.
Right.
So if you can get in that position, then pull up on the nose of your airplane, you've got him in the sights, and that's when you turn them loose. So know how many we got. They gave me credit for one Betty and one smoker. They gave credit for Teague for two smokers.
How many of those kills were you credited with in all throughout the war?
During the war, I was credited for three air kills. That doesn't count any of them that we killed. Like one time we went on Rabaul. Rabaul used to be a terrifically fighter base. So we caught the fighters there one time, still sleeping, and right away we did to them the flight of six fighters in my section. We went in single file, and it was just like, have you seen that picture what the Japanese did to Pearl Harbor? Just one right after the other, all 50s going. That's what we did to Rabaul. That didn't count, though. I got one, the first one, that was in the air, but the rest of them were all on the ground. But, you know, it's hard for me to even believe what I'm telling you. But how could I help it? my daughter one time. No, my granddaughter. Grandpa, you ought to write about this. So I wrote whatever I could about the Guadalcanal campaign, typed it up, and I just threw it on the desk. Nobody would believe that. Absolutely nobody. So I think it's still on my desk if it didn't get in the junk pile. That's all it was. Nothing but a 10-cent dime novel. What can I say? I was there. I did it.
This is radio. People can't see the look in your eye or the water coming out of your eyes, and I wish they could. They'd know how real this is for you. I want to follow up with some of those stories. I know I'm bouncing around a bit, but let's start with Guadalcanal. You said you wrote about it. What are the things that you saw? You're just a young kid in the Marines fighting the Japanese. What are the things that you saw and experienced on the ground in combat that were difficult for you?
Well, on one of the trips, we finally got to the top. And, of course, then down on the other side is the Japanese control. And they would start coming back up, throwing hand grenades. All they would use would be hand grenades. They would just toss them just maybe 20 feet ahead of them. That was to get rid of us. Well, this one Japanese I spotted real early. It was big for a Japanese. And he started up the hill, and pretty soon I couldn't see him. I was dug in a foxhole, looking over the side, and I couldn't see him. And then I saw him. He was got up on his knees, so I watched him. And he would come up on his hands and knees, then roll over on his back and just toss that grenade over him. He must have did that 4 or 5 times while he was coming up that side. When he got to the top, and I was being quiet because as soon as you fire, then the Japs know where you're coming from. So they get the small arms fire and gets you. So he got pretty about maybe 20 feet away from me, and he was a little bit off to the right, my right. For some reason or other, he didn't stand up. He got up on his knees, and he was just looking around. And then I could tell he spotted me. And he had hand grenade, and he's getting ready to throw it like this. And I had to cut him down. Just like that, another human being down the drain. Some poor mother. Yolly, why can I forget that? He was so surprised. That's why I knew he saw me. And I think I saw his hand start coming up with a grenade in it. And he'd have gotten me if I hadn't. That was when we had 15 men out of 62 left on that bloody knoll. You know, and you think about that bloody knoll. Once you start up it, boy, there's no turning back. There's no turning back. There's no eating, no sleeping. And sometimes you're gone 3, 4, 5 days up there, and they couldn't bring any supplies in. They couldn't even give us any ammo up there. That last time I went up it, they gave me 30 rounds. That's all the ammo we had. And with an O3, those 30 rounds could last 7 seconds, shooting left-handed. When you shoot left-handed, it's as close to a machine gun as you can possibly get, because all you're doing, you're holding the rifle left-handed, and all you do is reach over with your right and grab the bolt head. And with your left hand, you push the rifle over to the side, and while you're pushing it over, that ejects the spent shell. Then you put the rifle back, and that sends the bolt forward, and it replaces the spent shell with a live one. So all you're doing is pushing that rifle, just back and forth, back and pretty soon you're out of ammo. And then the only thing you got left to fight with is a bayonet. And how can you ever carry on a fight after 3, 4 days of starving? You don't have enough strength to wet without wetting in your pants. That's how weak you are. Then you finally roll back down. And it was sure great at the end of the third trip up, the 3rd Marine Division came in and they replaced us.
You went on to fight in the air after that, but so many more Marines died on all those islands in the Pacific. Yeah. How much respect do you have for those Marines who fought at Guadalcanal, at Tarawa, at Iwo Jima, at Okinawa, and Tinian and Saipan, and all those places?
Well, a lot.
Well, and after all, you were one of them initially, and I know we're bouncing around a little bit, but I get the sense that you had respect, and I know you didn't care for the enemy and what Imperial Japan had done to America, but it sounds like you had respect for some of those pilots that you went up against as well.
One pilot especially, we got into a wicked dogfight, and he was a good pilot. He was a real good pilot, I could tell, because he took me a while. But I finally got around in back of him, and the burst, I gave him a long burst, and right away it started to smoke. I got the oil cooler pretty fast. Then something blew up, and I wanted to see closer, so I pulled up on the side of him, and I gave him the bailout signal. Sure, he was my enemy, but he was a human being, and he lost the fight. The bailout signal was what they use today. It makes me laugh. That was bailout, you're on fire.
It's like a basketball coach calling timeout or something, huh?
That's what they're using today.
Yeah.
But that means bailout, you're on fire. And by then I was on his wing, and you could see blood in there on the canopy cover. He was all gone. His head was, he wasn't dead. It was like this. And I kept doing that, rocking my wings to try to catch his attention. He finally looked over. And you know what that SB did? He gave me the thumbs up signal and smiled at me. And he blew up. After I did what I did, he was acknowledging defeat and he was thanking me for trying to help.
I can see how that would stick with you.
Well, and you're in a dive bomber. The best way to go down on them is to try to get right above your target, then roll over on your back, then pull the nose down and go straight down and pick up all the speed you can get with the diving flaps open. But still you can get pick up some speed, because where you need it is when you come out of it, because while you're coming down, they're usually hiding behind something. And as soon as you start pulling up, you're not going to shoot them anymore. That's when the small arms fire kills you. And you very seldom ever fly your airplane in a straight line. You never fly it in a straight line, because all they know is, like if you're a dove hunter, you don't ever shoot at a dove. You always shoot to where the dove's going to be in 5 seconds. Same as with an airplane. If you're diving, you're going straight down, but your airplane's cocked off to the side like this, they're aiming, leading you over here. Well, you're not going over there. You're going this way. Your airplane is sliding.
Yeah.
Those are some of the things you learn the hard way.
And I've had some guys about dive bombers. They've told me when you get to the bottom of that dive and you start to pull up, that you actually black out. And you have stick the stick between your legs?
You do that every time.
You black out every time.
One time I was got into a dogfight with a pilot, and I always liked, because of that gunner I lost, to tell my man, take care of yourself, don't worry about me. And so we got into a circle going, and I couldn't get on him, and he wasn't able to get onto me. So he finally made a mistake. And the thing is, I rolled over on my back and pulled back hard. I knew I was going to black out, but you trim your airplane for that. So as soon as you let up on the pressure on the stick, you come to. And I pulled that trick on him. And when I came to, he was right there in front of me, dead center. His belly was right there. And you can see his pieces of his airplane flying off. But it was just a matter of, that's where all the training in boot camp really paid off. You know, we always hated that, but we were tough. I mean, physically tough. And the guy that can stay blacked out, that means he doesn't have any blood up here. He's going to end up being the winner. Because if I black out, you're going to black out, because you're going to match me.
Right.
But if I can stay there a second longer, I've got you. Just that simple.
It sure, I mean, obviously, I've never done that, but it seems scary to me, and it seems like it takes a lot of faith to believe you're going to come to again, and or that you're going to come to in time.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, but you're that's right. You never know for sure.
Well, one thing I know for sure is that I want to hear more of Augie Palacios' story next time. We're out of time for now. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.